Killing Type, a novel by Wayne Jones, Chapter 13. On one of those DVDs that Rachel alerted me to at the library, some self-acknowledged expert professes categorically that 5 is the, quote, magic number, unquote, a direct quote, alas, of murders at which the international media start paying attention. He had done a comprehensive survey of serial killings in the United States and Europe since the 1960s, and the overall trend was that one or two or three murders garnered hardly any interest outside the host country or city unless they were particularly heinous. 4 was the transition point between trends, and at 5 murders there was a bona fide news story which merited various degrees of coverage depending on each media outlet's tendencies and financial capacity. Here in Nosting, with Rodney Tweed turning the deadly odometer over to the requisite number, the facts sadly re-corroborate the research. I am up at 8:45 on Saturday morning, the phone ringing, and the misdialer on the other end not having the decency to apologize but simply hanging up when he realizes I am not his bud. I trudge crankily into the kitchen to put on the coffee, and when I return from picking up the newspapers, the pot is joyously full. I pour a cup, tincture of sugar, splash of cream, and then settle into the couch to read. I am just recovering from another poorly worded headline when a vehicle goes by fast outside on the street, which is just meters from where I am seated, and then another, and then another. Happily tossing the thing aside and seeing it dangle off the arm of the sofa like a modifier in a mediocre newspaper, I get up and separate the slats of the blinds to have a look. There's a man standing not 3 meters from my front door, now talking with increasing animation to 2 other men. I recognize the trio it is, reporter, sound, and camera. "Fucking police station is down that way, I'm sure," the sound man says, indicating north. "Yeah," says the cameraman. The reporter seems unconvinced. "Let's just get down there wherever the damn thing is." They walk down the street. I reposition myself, leaning to the left, and open the slats a little wider. They put the equipment into the back of an SUV, get in at 3 separate doors, and drive away too quickly for me to discern their station letters. I've lost all interest in today's paper now, and I have an off feeling that my appetite for reporting on murders will be seriously diminished by this onslaught. However, I do maintain a sense of responsibility for the whole project. Some good will come from my investigation and book, and so I get ready quickly so that I can go downtown to verify my worst fears. I exit my apartment and start walking up the street with a feeling of hope and adventure in spite of the media invasion. I heard at least 2 more vehicles while I was shaving. The air is cool and the gawking pedestrian traffic is light as I take a left off Johnson and head for the square in front of City Hall. I hear a muffled but strong rumbling as I approach my destination, and as I round my final corner and finally arrive, the sight is disgusting and spectacular and disheartening all at once. I count at least 20 vehicles, each with a bevy of people around them, and from many countries too, like the worst kind of parody of international cooperation. In the midst of it all, and just as I am about to turn around and go right back home, returning later when my stamina has been reinstated, I hear my name, or think I do. I turn around and see Tony running toward me like a child to her uncle at the fair. "Isn't this wild?" she says. "I guess I'm not surprised to see you here." "Oh, now, that sounds a little disapproving." The woman has elicited more than I intended to share, and I've been a boob as well. "Sorry, didn't mean it that way," I lie. "Just that, you know, it's murder, and we both know that we're both interested in this kind of thing." She laughs disconcertingly. "I have a feeling," she starts, and there is a loud explosion of something or other to punctuate her thought. "I have a feeling that this media presence is going to do more for solving this damn thing than all the police officers and all the donut shops in town." Flippant though her assessment is, I contemplate its validity. I do detest the circus that has evidently come to town, sans elephant, but I can't argue with throwing every resource imaginable at the problem, easing up on the tendency to be cautious and comprehensive and systematic about the investigation, and instead creating a mess out of which one hopes eventually to extract one shining gem. There was a rumor making its way around town a few weeks ago that the police, or was it the mayor, had engaged the services of a psychic. My first reaction, of course, was that it was a ridiculous waste of time and money, and even somewhat of an insult to victims whose deaths go unresolved while civic officials fiddle around with fake powers. But suddenly one evening I couldn't imagine the possible harm in trying everything, no matter how valid. I abhorred the chicanery of psychic powers and divining and the rest of it, but as long as the police were not actually diverting their efforts entirely to parading some bescarfed charlatan around to former crime scenes, well, who am I to judge? You might be right, I say to her, smiling falsely and pretending to mean it. So, I know it might be an obvious question, but why are you here anyway? I was about to ask you the same thing. There's a pause while we both calculate whose move this results in. Okay, well, I know you have a nobler cause than I do, and I feel a bit like the dumb chick at the road concert, she is smart enough to say. I mean, you can chalk it up to research, but I'm just here for the spectacle. You know, see how crude and mean the media can really get. This sly girl's forthrightness is disarming. My motives may not be any better than that. Unconsciously on both sides, I think, we have proceeded to walk together alongside the metal barricade which encloses all the vehicles and their denizens. We are exposed to the back ends of the vehicles for the most part, the same ugly practicality that one sees along the literal and figurative edges of a fairground, keeping the pretty things operating. Good that they keep them caged up, I guess, so that they don't get out and maul anyone. I smile. Actually, it reminds me of my days in the theater, Tony says. Getting dressed up, putting on makeup, sprucing up, all of that. I wonder if at some point they actually sit down and try to figure things out, or even just to come up with some good questions. She's right again, damn her. It's a bit sad, isn't it? I mean, one could imagine that if they all knocked their heads together, as well as exercised their power, the Fourth Estate and all of that, then they might actually be able to force or shame someone into doing something about this mess. Or perhaps they might figure it out for themselves. Oh, now you're just talking crazy talk. She shakes her head at me faux seriously. We continue along the long edge of the barricade and finally round the corner, making our way toward the water. I have a crazy temptation, lasting just a nanosecond, to run screaming into the lake, decrying loudly the poor state of investigative journalism just before I 1.5 gainer it into the water, screaming even more loudly about the inept police before I flop in spectacularly. There's even more activity on this edge of the barricade, starting with a very large man applying his own makeup while his camera and sound operators, both women, wait patiently, and culminating in another man actually being slapped across the face. For what reason, I am happy not to know. A bench, Tony suggests, and I nod approvingly. The silence and solitude are genuinely soothing as we make it to the side of the water and find an idyllic little bench under a tree. I have to admit to being a little suspicious of Tony. I'm fairly certain that she's not the killer, but there is something disingenuous in her interactions with me that I find troubling, even though I cannot quite identify the problem. So how goes the research for the book, she asks. I haven't seen you at the library, and I've wondered whether maybe you just gave up the whole thing. Oh, not at all. I've changed my schedule a little, that's probably part of it, but I've also been doing a lot of reading at home. The other thing, and this may sound a little precious, the other thing is that I've just been trying to spend some quiet time, sometimes at home, sometimes right here along the lake or in the park, just trying to think, to try to figure things out. I hate the fact that she is so straightforward. I always say too much. I feel like that caricature of a nervous suspect whom the police have sent their most adept interrogator to shake down. the officer showing up in civilian clothes and seemingly distracted by the quality of coffee at the station or the antics of his misbehaving teenage son. But somewhere in the aw shucks method, he manages to extract a confession. "I've been thinking about it myself," she says. "Oh? Yes, I've developed a sort of conspiracy theory. It's crazy, but..." She trails off and looks at me for permission to indulge. "Go on." "Okay, it's like this. The main question is, who has benefited most from these murders?" "Benefited? Obviously not the dead people or their families, but look at the cops and the media and the mayor's new, what's he calling it, crime agenda now. They're getting attention and funding, and the people are just following along like sheep. I'm no better myself. If it takes $1 billion to find this guy, I'm willing to pay the higher taxes or for the city to go into debt so that we can fund it." I let the utter ludicrousness of her theory settle into my already harried brain a little before I reply. "I'm having some difficulty fathoming exactly what you're suggesting," I say diplomatically, trying to avoid the tone I might use with, say, a child who had just told me about a monster in her bedroom. "You're not saying that the police and the mayor and... what are you saying exactly?" I am experiencing genuine difficulty framing my response as part of a conversation that adults might be having. "No, of course not. I'm not saying that they're all in on it or anything like that." She seems slightly angry. "I mean, I'm not implying that they're sitting around in City Hall hashing out who's going to get whacked next and who should they hire to do it." She laughs now, and I take some relief in that. "So?" I prod. "I guess my main point is that it's in the interest of many police and civic officials to let this drag on a bit. Not that they're killing, of course, but that maybe they aren't trying their hardest to track the guy down. All these people murdered, some of them in pretty horrific ways, and they don't even have a lead or a suspect or anything? It boggles the mind. The longer it goes on and there is nobody caught, the more money that gets added to their law and order budget or whatever." Though this more nuanced assessment is several degrees superior to what I had suspected, I still remain flummoxed at the relative simple-mindedness of her analysis. Yes, the facts are as she says they are, but I am not cynical enough, perhaps, to reduce this mess to a merely financial rationale. I see incompetence and a lack of drive in the police and in the general coordination of the investigation. One hesitates even to grace it with this word, but nothing more sinister than that. "I'm not sure I agree," I say rather hesitantly. "The most I would say is that it might be as you say, but only unconsciously." "Yes, maybe you have a point. In fact, I hope you are right, because even the hint of what I am suggesting makes me very worried and depressed." There's a loud thudding sound, which startles us both, and when we turn around to look at its source within the barricade, there is another, though more muted. We get up immediately and run toward the vehicles. Tony ahead of me at a good clip, and me, alas, lagging and panting. I see flames and shout that fact to her, and she adjusts her trajectory to head in that direction. Tony arrives, and I pull up behind her about 5 seconds later. I can feel the heat from a small fire, but most noticeable is the panicked shouting on the part of several of the media people within the barricade. "What the fucking fuck?" I hear. The strictured eloquence not really boding well for the future of informed, articulate reporting in this town. Tony, ever the bold charmer, goes over to one of the reporters who is standing to the side observing the melee. I run up behind her, staying close enough to hear the conversation, but far enough away so as not to spook the reporter. "So what gives?" she says. "It's nothing really," says the reporter, evidently more interested in the territory of Tony's physique than in prosaic explosions. "Someone dropped a match into a chemical or something that one of the women was using for her hair, I think. Or maybe it was one of the men." He laughs, and so does Tony. "What the hell could go in anyone's hair that would be that explosive?" "That's just one of the stories. I've also heard there was a fight between one of the male reporters and his camera woman. He claimed she shot him in bad light or something and made him look bad on camera. She said, well, I've heard it quoted like, I didn't have much to work with. And then he apparently threw something at her, which ended up in a vat of something. The details are a little fuzzy, and who knows what's the truth anyway. Tony turns away to rejoin me, and I can see that the reporter is interested in her departing assets as well. Quite disgusting. Did you catch that? She says. I sigh in response, and we both head away from the barricade as we hear the sirens of the fire trucks making their way closer.